Just 7 years ago from yesterday, I sat right there on that front row. Dr. Parrott stood where I now stand. A huge multi-ethnic choir on risers from Redeemer Presbyterian Church stood right there. My husband's casket stood right here. And today is my first time in this space since that day. I found it uncanny that the speaking date Dr. Parrott and I agreed upon happened to fall the week of the 7th anniversary of my husband's death. February 26, 2011 marks the beginning and the ending for me. The ending of a 25-year romance with the love of my life. The beginning of my journey through what I came to call my midnight hour. With my three teenagers seated beside me, my family all around me, and my best friends directly behind me, we grappled with our intense grief over the tragic ending of my husband's life. 4 days prior, Michael Branco was killed in a car accident. Within just minutes of our phone conversation, when he said the words, "Good night, I love you," on the phone. Good night, I love you. A simple phrase, one most of us say every day of our lives. We say it to our parents at bedtime as a child. We say it to someone we love as we roll over and fall asleep. We even say it on the phone while separated from those we love. The words easily and mindlessly just roll off our lips. But we never consider they may be the last words that we speak to the person who holds part of our heart. Dr. Parrott welcomed the audience that day, 900 plus people seated and standing along the walls. We had to close the door almost an hour before the service began, while literally hundreds were turned away for lack of seating and space. Because Michael made such an impact on so many people, we knew we wouldn't be able to hold his visitation in our church. He was the campus architect here at Belhaven University, with his first building being the Bitsy Irving Building. And what a beautiful addition it is to the campus. He and Dr. Parrott had more than a business relationship. They had a mutual respect for one another, and they gained a friendship through their years together working. Because of this mutual relationship and friendship, Dr. Parrott offered this space to us for both the visitation and the memorial service. When Dr. Parrott stood up here that day, he explained this building was originally a large church until it came under the ownership of Belhaven. Michael did the renovation plan to transform it into what you know today as the Center for the Arts. When Michael was in the redesign phase for the layout of the sanctuary, Dr. Parrott told us how they brainstormed all the different ways that they could utilize this space. Michael suggested that the flow could even work for a funeral if needed. Almost 9 years later, Michael's funeral was the first funeral held in this space. I was numb in the months that followed. My thoughts were all over the place. My thoughts were, so what now? Where do I even begin? Where do I go from here? Am I even breathing? I can't feel anything. My body went into autopilot. My mornings, days, and nights ran together in one long string of survival. I realized the proverb I'd clung to as my daily mantra for the previous 20 years had been deeply rooted in me for such a time as this. Let your eyes look straight ahead and your eyelids right before you. Ponder the path of your feet and let all your ways be established. I had no idea how crucial this verse would become for my very survival during life's most difficult times. My daily self-talk began with, just do the next thing, Janae. Keep your eyes straight ahead. Take it slowly and intentionally take the next step. Life must continue, and it did. I kept breathing. I got out of bed each day. I faced my grief head on, wanting to learn all I could from it. Grief is a long journey down a road of utter darkness and pain with an unknown distance of how long you have to travel before the sun is going to rise again. But I kept taking the next step and the next with an unaware boldness. I share all this with you to show the weight and depth of the loss I experienced. But grief is universal. Loss is universal. They are inescapable. You all have felt it, been there, or you're going to. What will you do with it? What will you do with the loss when it shows up? When trauma strikes? These are difficult questions to answer until they punch you in the stomach and they take your breath away. You can begin. You can't prepare for it happening to you, but you can work on what to do when it happens to somebody else. No matter how indirectly or directly loss strikes your world, once it comes to your own doorstep, the compassion for others quickly rises when you learn someone else has just opened their door to find inescapable death and grief waiting for them. What do you do when loss of any kind arrives at the doorstep of your friend? How will you help? Will you have the courage to join them and step into their circle of pain? Or as a singer-songwriter, Krista Wells, puts it in her song entitled, Come Closer Now, will you sit with them in the burn where their world is raging with flames? Your best friend back home calls you to tell you his sister just died of an accidental overdose. Your roommate gets a call from home informing her that her mom has had a stroke and is on life support now. Your teammate has had a four-wheeler accident over break and is now paralyzed from the neck down. Someone in your friend group walks into his garage at home and discovers his dad has committed suicide. What will you do? As Job says, a despairing man should have the devotion of his friends. In his book, one of my husband's favorite books and mine, The Purpose-Driven Life, also entitled, What on Earth Am I Here For? Rick Warren explains there are four levels of fellowship. He describes the fourth one this way. The deepest, most intense is the fellowship of suffering, when we enter into each other's pain and grief and carry each other's burdens. A couple of months after Michael died, I spoke with the wife of one of his colleagues, and she said people miss out so much by not going there with those that are in pain. It's actually a precious time, and we can learn so much from it. Death is as much a part of life and the experience as life itself. We can learn as much from it as we can from life. It takes a long time to work through the fog, but when it slowly begins to lift, we see things differently. And if you don't, you might need to double check your heart. Why do people want to rush through it or push it down or away as if it's not really there? This is life. Death is part of life. We must deal with death, grow in wisdom and compassion through it with our friends as they walk through their loss. Warren also says, it is in times of deep crisis, grief, and doubt that we need each other most. When circumstances crush us to the point that our faith falters, that's when we need believing friends the most. We need a small group of friends to have faith in God for us and to pull us through. I was blessed with a group of friends who fit into this category. They entered into my pain and grief and helped me carry my burdens. This image reminds me of the story in Exodus of how Aaron and Hur helped Moses during the battle against the Amalekites. Moses climbs up a hill above the battle that Joshua is leading down in the valley, and Aaron and Hur accompany him. Well, as Moses holds his staff up with his hand while it's up in the air. The Israelites are gaining. When his arms come down, the Amalekites get the advantage. The scripture says Moses' arms soon became so tired he could no longer hold them up. So Aaron and Hur found a stone for him to sit on. We would pull up a chair. Then they stood on each side of Moses, holding up his hands. So his hands held steady until sunset, and the victory was won. I love this story. I refer to it frequently. Aaron and Hur could have simply grabbed Moses' arms and lifted them up in the air, but instead they moved in and they came closer. They found a stone for him to sit on. They provided a place for him to rest. They made sure he was comfortable. Then they stepped in, basically interceding on his behalf. They held him up because he was too weak to do it alone. I imagine them, the only way that could have happened for him to be seated and them to be holding the arms, they were probably physically touching him and had his back and his arm supporting him. This is compassion in action, and this is the fellowship of the suffering. There is nothing that will test our friendships more, cause relationships to build and mature, or at worst, fall away, than death, loss, and grief. I'm honored and privileged to have several remaining incredibly strong friendships. The friends who remain constant are those who continued to come towards me. They didn't simply say, "You know I'm here if I need you, just call me." It doesn't work that way. These friends took the initiative. They didn't offer advice, but what they did offer was more valuable and needful. They offered their ears to listen, a shoulder for me to cry, and their time when I needed companionship. This is what the fellowship of the suffering looks like. After speaking to countless people who have suffered loss, they all contend that calling someone when they had a need wasn't something they did, even though the invitation was put out there by well-meaning friends. If you put that invitation out there, don't expect a call. During this stage of grieving, it requires too much strength, and we don't even know our own needs. So how and why would we call and say, "This is what I need," because we have no idea. We cannot think or take our emotions very far beyond our self-imposed grief boundaries, the circle of grief where we find ourselves. Friends are welcome to enter into our circle, into our fellowship, but it isn't often we step outside of our circle looking for a listening ear or help in any way. We need the support to come to us. I honor my friends who had the courage to enter into my circle of grief. They bravely crossed over the boundaries and gave without expecting anything in return. It was a one-sided friendship for years after Michael died. I needed much without anything to give. I am just now beginning to feel as if I have something to give back, and it feels so good to return the same level of fellowship that they gave me. The ability slowly emerged, which meant my friends had to continue to reside patiently within my circle of grief. You see me here today on this stage, and you may think I'm an extrovert. I require great amounts of time alone to nourish my heart, soul, and spirit, as well as my body and my creativity. I require very little socializing. I am not an extrovert, but I am an introvert to the core. And I despise small talk. Not because I don't like to talk to people. If that were true, I would not even be standing here today. Clearly, there are some situations when small talk serves its purposes, but as a whole, it exhausts me. It exhausts me because it's exactly what the word implies, small talk. And I like big talk. I thrive on talking about things that matter. I survive in small talk situations by locating someone who's willing to go beyond the superficial, or they have unknowingly revealed a crack in their wall and I spot it. I ask questions, I dig a little bit into their story, then I make a connection. It was my mode of survival. Ask questions, look them in the eye, listen intently. I found many people are not used to conversing with people who care to listen about the real things. But now it's beyond a mode of survival. It's my search for people who are hurting and who are searching for a fellowship of the suffering. This aversion to small talk only exacerbated after Michael died. If there were a list, and if you're on your cell phone now, you can perk up because I'm going to start giving you rules to go by. If there were a list of rules to read before bravely trying to enter in someone's circle of grief, rule number one would be, don't try small talk. It is not welcome here. John Eldridge, a New York Times bestselling author, lost a friend of his to cancer in 2016. Shortly after, he wrote about the importance of soul care during those months of intense grieving. He listed all the things that were helpful to his soul and all the things that were harmful to his soul. And this one jumped out at me because it resonated so deeply with me personally. He included this in the list of things that were harmful, and I quote, draining people wanting to talk to me. Then he goes on to say, friends and family are at this moment probably wondering which category they fell into. It's quite simple. Draining people are those who live out of touch with their own soul, and thus mine. Instead, ask questions. Real questions like, how is your heart today? And just wait. Don't fill the space with words, empty words. Another way to honor your friend while sitting within their circle of grief is to allow them both time inside and outside the box. I talk about this coping mechanism in my book, Good Night, I Love You. My children and I were often on different tracks of the grieving process. Sometimes there were two of us inside the box, while two were outside the box. One inside the box crying, one inside the box watching a movie alone, or one wanting to talk, one wanting to be silent, one wanting to be happy and move on, one wanting to fall back. It was and is a continual back and forward motion. But after observing the differences on how we approach grief, I also found a commonality. We both needed time inside and outside the box, which I started calling the grief box. Inside the box is where we go to handle our deep pain, our thoughts, and our tears in private. It is inside the box where we absorb most of the shock from each wave of grief. Outside the box is where we attempt to live our normal lives in the land of the living. We went outside to survive. We went inside to survive. We needed both places. Think of inside the box as the inner circle within the circle of grief. This is where your friend may need to be alone or just sit silently in your presence. When I went inside my box, I disappeared to my bedroom. I sat on my bed, or I stood or sat inside my closet with the door closed. But I also wrote on my blog inside the box. My practice of writing became my primary way of dealing with my grief while inside my box. Writing became a container, a box, for where my pain and questions and musings on life were able to find a place. And it's important to find a container for your emotions, whatever that looks like. It's important to honor your friend when they need to step away inside their box alone. And it's okay. And it's healthy. Some people sat outside, literally, sat outside my door and waited for me to come out from inside the box. Others never left the house no matter what. They simply moved around quietly, bringing peace just with their presence. Rule number two, at the gate of the circle of grief, no judgment of actions or duration, inside or outside the box. Grieving is a long road, so friends, hang in there with us. Allow us to take our time, handle us with care, hug us, listen to us, not too much advice. Love, pray often, join us when we stop to rest, and as we reflect on the loss and recognize the deep void that we're now living with. It hurts whether we're inside or outside the box. Maybe some of you have read this book before, The Little Paris Bookshop. Nina George tells a magnificent story of Monsieur Perdue, a Parisian bookseller who thinks of himself as a literary apothecary from his floating bookshop on the River Seine. He prescribes books for the hardships of life, prescribing the exact book what a reader needs. Perdue mends broken hearts and souls, but the only person he's not been able to heal is himself. He's been grieving for 20 years over the loss of his lover. She didn't die, but abandoned him, leaving him only a letter behind, and he's yet to read the letter. He's afraid to go there. In one small tender scene, Perdue checks on a neighbor who has recently been deserted by her husband. Noticing her reflection in the frosted window in her front door, he quietly knocks, then addresses her through the door. Without ever opening it, she leans in and she speaks through the frosted glass. He closely watches her reflection. She says, "I need to cry some more. I'll drown if I don't. Can you understand that?" Monsieur Perdue responds, "Of course. Sometimes you're swimming in unwept tears, and you'll go under if you store them up inside. I'm at the bottom of the sea of tears. I'll bring you a book on tears then." Even King David knew how to let out all of his tears. "I am weary with my groaning," he says. "All night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with tears. My eyes waste away because of grief. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity, for the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication." The voice of my weeping. Our cries have voice to God. Crying doesn't mean you've lost your faith. You are simply human and hurting, and you need God's presence more than ever. He doesn't abandon you during this time, but he sits right beside you, grieves with you, feels your pain. Your tears, your cries, they are your prayers. Rule number three, don't let your friends drown in unwept tears. Be and choose to be that safe place for them. As someone who survived the suffocating trauma within the epicenter of the circle of grief, I have spent much time contemplating tangible, specific words of advice. Words I can give not only to those friends who are choosing to enter in someone else's circle, but also to those who have been hurled unexpectedly into their own circle of grief. What words can I offer to help them move forward? What are the most basic things I can say to help them heal on this journey through their dark circle? I remember going to see my internist a couple of months after Michael died. My heart rate and blood pressure were all over the place. My sleep completely non-existent. He offered basic advice. Cry. When you feel the urge arise, cry. Don't push it down. Let it out. There will be times when you need to hold it together, but when you can and where you can, go ahead and cry. I walked away from that appointment feeling empowered. Someone had told me what to do. I love a bullet point list. I'm a just give me the facts, bottom line kind of person. My mind made a mental note. Cry. It's good for me. If I could tell someone what to do, as the doctor told me, I would give them my bullet points. And if I'd planned ahead, I would have put them on the screen behind me. But here are my bullet points, as his. Cry, or you may drown. Don't apologize for your tears. Lay down stoicism. Get out of bed each and every day. Journal. It's the only way I survived. Make time for solitude. Do the next thing. Then do the next thing. And the next thing. Take the healing process seriously, because it is serious. Run towards God, not away. Choose wisely whom you allow in your inner circle of grief. The ones who will feel comfortable with your silence, comfortable with your vulnerability and your pain. Take deep breaths frequently. Talk about what you lost. Remember. Take care of your grief. Treat the wound. Practice soul care. Don't put grief in a closet or sweep it under the rug to make your life look neat and clean. Don't go back to business as usual too soon. Change up your routine in any way. Occasionally, do hard things. They may seem impossible in the moment, but they are essential to heal and to keep you moving forward. So do the next thing and do a hard thing. And as my mantra from Proverbs, let your eyes look straight ahead and your eyelids right before you. As I look at people in their inner circle, I can see the fear on their faces as they anticipate the steps and the days to come on this long, dark road that they are traveling, and they have no map because one does not exist. They must only keep moving forward. I yearn to help them carry the load. I yearn to open the skies above them so the suffocating air can be released. I yearn to go before them with a shield and blaze the trail for them. But it's something they must, and we all must, experience alone. It is a singular journey. We can silently hold their hand, bring them provisions, and listen to their tales of the journey. But in the end, it's their journey. We all inevitably embark on this path at some point in our lives. My only mental preparation that I had was my faith in God. It was the place from which I drew my strength and protection while I traversed on this path of sheer darkness. It was my source of hope, my source of healing and peace when everything around me raged. Today, I glance back into the dark valley of which I have finally emerged, and I can barely make out the silhouettes in the distance, crawling their way into the dark valley. And I just pray, Lord, be with them, rescue them, hold them, protect them, cast a light on them. My hope in verbalizing these thoughts today is to give all of us courage to let grief out of the closet. Let's feel comfortable discussing it with our friends. Let's give one another freedom to experience the depth of its pain without the fear of judgment. Let's extend a hand to the griever and sit with them in their solitude, or even invite them to come out for a while. Let's work together to create a safe social environment where we can begin a transparent and vulnerable conversation about what loss feels like and what it looks like from the inside of the circle of grief. I want to leave you with this song by Krista Wells. It's spoken from the voice of a friend who's trying to navigate her way into the delicate circle of grief of someone. She asks, What can I bring to your fire? Shall I sing while your roof is burning down? Can I hold you while the flames grow higher? Shall I brave the heat and come close with you now? Can I come close now?
Shall I sing while the roof is coming down? Would you guys join me in thanking Janae for her transparency and her challenge to us this morning? Amen. Thank you. Hey, we gotta take care of our souls. We gotta take care of each other. Okay. In light of all that, week after week, we say our benediction verse together. Let's say it together again. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind has conceived what God has prepared.